welcome to the Science Podcast for March 21st, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the evolution of how we all started walking on two legs, subliminal influences on behavior, and farewell thoughts from science's senior correspondent Gene Marks after 35 years of science reporting. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
When did our ancestors first walk on two legs? In a paper in This Week Science, Brian Richmond and William Jungers provide detailed analysis of the earliest fossil evidence of human lineage, a femur from Auroran tugenensis, and confirm that the species was walking on two legs as early as 6 million years ago. I visited Richmond in his lab in Washington, D.C.
I'm Brian Richmond. I'm an associate professor at George Washington University, and we are here in the Paleoanthropology Laboratory. Well, let me pull out a few fossil bones here.
Now, what are we looking at?
Okay, we are going to be looking at a chimpanzee femur, which is the thigh bone, and a human femur thigh bone to show you some of the differences. And this provides the context for the fossil discoveries and interpretation of those fossil discoveries.
So these are modern human and modern chimpanzee?
Modern human and modern chimpanzee bones. So let's pull out a chimpanzee thigh bone right here, and we'll set it down. And human one gets them down here.
That's much longer.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually the key difference. You've seen it right away, is that humans have much longer legs than chimpanzees do, whereas they have longer arms than we do. Now, the fossil that this paper is about only preserves the top maybe two-thirds or so, so we don't have the full length. It looks like it's probably in between in length, between what you see in humans and chimpanzees. But all we really have is then the top part. And the real question is, for this fossil that dates back to 6 million years ago, is whether or not it has the anatomy for upright walking or not. We know from fossil and DNA evidence that our common ancestor with chimpanzees goes back to some 5 to 7 million years ago. So at 6 million years, this fossil is right at the time period that we could have an early chimpanzee, an early human ancestor, the common ancestor, or something altogether different.
So it's just the top two-thirds. You don't necessarily know that it is two-thirds. It could be one-fourth or some other fraction.
Well, we're sure that it's at least a half, because of some of the structure of the back of the shaft of the femur. So we know that we at least have about half. It's probably closer to two-thirds, but we can't be sure about the exact length.
What are some of the other differences?
Okay, some of the key differences are that humans have a much larger joint because we bear all the weight of our body on two legs instead of four. So you have to have bigger joints to bear all that extra weight. The other characteristics, though, that characterize our early ancestors is that they have very long necks on the thigh bone, and these long necks help for the muscles on the side of your hip to balance your body during walking. That connection, that neck, so right in that hip socket, there is some distance between the hip socket and where the shaft begins and goes on down to the knee. And that distance away gives us all the room for those thigh muscles that help us during walking.
Now, are there any other key differences besides the length and the neck?
Sure. One of the other key differences is the shape of the shaft. Because of the way we walk, we walk in a very stereotypical way. I mean that we use a regular pattern over and over and over again when we walk. So every time we take a step, we're loading our body weight onto our lower limbs in a very regular, repeated way. And what apes do, like the chimpanzee, is they use their limbs in all sorts of ways. So they'll sometimes walk on the ground, sometimes they're climbing trees, sometimes they'll hang from their legs, and we don't do all of that. Because they use their lower limbs in such versatile ways, they end up having really rounded shafts that are good and strong in all directions. And since we use our limbs in very stereotypical ways, they're particularly strong in particular directions. Another characteristic, too, is that we tend to use our hip muscles to keep the whole hip level, so it doesn't drop to one side and drop to the other side. And that's actually where the muscles are involved in this kind of hip anatomy. That's the relevant context for understanding these bones.
I see, too, that there's some sort of big bend here of the human, and it's not so much in the chimpanzee. Is that because of the roundness?
That's a good question. There is more of a curvature to the long bone part of the thigh bone in a human compared to a chimpanzee. And this curvature really is related to the positioning of muscles. And it gets a little complicated, but the muscles that connect between your hip and the shaft of the femur, they have to attach along the back, and it has to be curved in order for them to work properly. We use those muscles, though, in a very different way than chimpanzees do. So that's another characteristic that makes the human thigh bone so distinctive and tells us that it's a thigh bone designed for upright walking.
So now with the context, there's more.
Well, that's the main context for the anatomy. And now what comes into play now is this interesting fossil that was found by a French team in the year 2000 in remote parts of Kenya. And they know because of the age of the sediments there that the fossil is almost 6 million years old. What has been unsettled and hasn't been answered well yet is whether or not this fossil hip bone was really one designed for upright walking, or was it one that is more the shape we'd expect for an ape doing ape kinds of things.
And how do you tell that difference?
We tell that difference because of these features we've just mentioned. And this fossil that's called Auroran tugenensis is the name. This fossil hip bone has the hallmark features of our early ancestors. It has a really long neck, and it has that shaft structure that looks like other hominin or human ancestors' thigh bones. And it doesn't look anything like a modern or a fossil ape. So we know that this thigh bone was adapted to upright walking on two legs all the way back at 6 million years ago.
What were some of the tools and techniques that you used to look at these very small differences probably between these different bones?
Well, in this study, we used some fairly standard techniques in anthropology, which is to use a tool called a caliper that just measures fairly precisely the size of different parts of the bone. And then we used statistical analyses to sort out what characteristics are just due to size of the bone itself and what characteristics are due to the shape of the bone. And that way we were able to really show that the fossil Auroran compares statistically well with hominin bones that are 2 and 3 million years ago and not like apes and not even like modern humans. They look like hominins that are 2 and 3 million years ago, even though this is a 6 million-year-old fossil. And it shows that it is also a human ancestor then. The other really interesting thing about this finding is that at 6 million years ago, the fossil looks so similar to things that are 2 and 3 million years ago that it suggests that when our early ancestors started walking upright, they evolved a hip anatomy that remained stable for 4 million years for the majority of human evolutionary history. And there weren't further changes until about 2 million years ago with the origin of our own genus Homo.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Brian Richmond is lead author of a paper on the evolution of human bipedalism. Read the paper and a related news article in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, self-sterility in animals. Yoshito Harada and colleagues report they found the molecular mechanism that keeps the hermaphroditic worm, Ciona intestinalis, from inbreeding. Two genetic loci contain a tightly linked pair of genes, one that gives rise to a protein that coats the egg, and another that acts as a sperm protein receptor. It's the interactions between these proteins that prevent self-fertilization. The system is similar to how some flowering plants keep from pollinating themselves, though with different molecules involved in the self-recognition process. You can read more about it at www.scienceexpress.org. Exert vigorous strength. If these words were given to you subliminally, research has shown that you probably would expend more effort than you normally would in doing some task, such as squeezing a hand grip. In a paper in this week's Science, Henk Otts and colleagues at the University of Utrecht show that by subliminally adding motivational words like good, pleasant, and nice to the effort words, people also squeezed longer. I spoke with Otts from his home in the Netherlands about preparing and motivating people's behavior outside of their awareness.
So what we're trying to do is we have a kind of idea that when a certain type of behavior, and we use the concept of physical exertion, So if you prime that concept by meaningful words or expose participants, people outside of awareness or subliminally to these kind of words, then the body is in some sense prepared to follow that kind of concept, so to say. So if you expose participants to words like exertion and effort and that kind of words, then people start to move their body covertly but not overtly to act in line with these concepts. And that's what we try to figure out, whether that can work in an experiment. That's one part of the story. And we also demonstrate that people indeed are prepared to exert physically on a hand grip task. But we also want to understand how people may be motivated to do that. So preparing is one thing, but motivating them is another thing. And the idea behind that is when you have this concept, let's say, of physical exertion, that is co-activated, going together in the mind with positive information. So this positive information may serve as a kind of a very basic reward signal. Then this concept of physical exertion becomes a motivated concept, and therefore people want to put effort in a certain task, and again, without knowing it. And that's what we tested.
So you had basically two experiments, one in which people were subliminally primed with a word like vigorous, and they squeezed the hand grip harder.
Exactly, yeah. But this is not two experiments, it's one experiment. So we have three different groups of participants, and in one group, the participants only are exposed to positive words, and in the other group, they are exposed to physical exertion words and positive words, but these two types of words are not going together. And in a third group, we expose them to physical exertion words together at the same time. It's only 200 milliseconds between it, with positive words, positive stimuli. And the last group is the so-called motivated group, because there, in that group, the physical exertion concept and positive reward signals are going together, and that makes the act of physical exertion a motivated action.
What were some of the motivating words?
These are positive words like, for example, nice and good, fine. So these are words that have a positive valence, so to say. They are not really motivating by nature, I mean not by meaning, but because the only thing participants can do in their task is encoding the valence of the word, apart from the meaning, of course. But the valence is doing the trick. So they encounter this word like nice or good. And what we know from other research, what people usually do is they automatically evaluate these words, and what they extract from it, it's positive. And this positive tag, so to say, is attached to this physical exertion concept. And these things together, outside of awareness, motivate a person to put effort in a task.
So this group performed the hand grip task the best, or the strongest, and the
quickest.
Yeah,
they do. Yeah, but the new thing about this experiment, because that was never tested, is trying to disentangle the preparation of behavior. You can examine whether people are prepared to put effort in a task. But that's only preparation. You can only extract from that they are prepared to exert physically. And the third group in which we co-activate this concept of physical exertion with positive information, they do the same thing as the preparation group. But in addition to that, they also keep on squeezing in the hand grip. So that means that they are persistent. And in the other group, which are only exposed to physical exertion words and not co-activated with positive reward signals, they go back to baseline immediately after they squeeze the hand grip. So they only are ready to squeeze more forcefully, if you like, but they don't keep on. And that means they are not motivated, only prepared.
What are the larger implications for this? I mean, this kind of subliminal priming isn't something that we would normally accept in society.
I think there are two things. One is the subliminal prime concept, if you like, gives us the opportunity to understand at least what people can do outside of awareness, apart from persuasion or influence by itself. So as a psychological scientist, I'm interested in what the mind can do for us without that we know it, yeah? And subliminal priming gives you a good sense of testing that because you're not aware of the source of your behavior, so to say, because you do things but you're not aware of where it comes from. It gives you a good equipment, methodology to examine that this preparation and motivational behavior can take place without a conscious will, if you like. We don't need a kind of a conscious will to start this behavior. So that's one thing. And implications for that is, of course, I think, discussion about what free will may be and how that may fit into justice systems and so on and so on and law. So that's one implication on a more theoretical level. And then on a more application level, well, I'm not really trying to argue here that subliminal priming can change whole patterns of behavior for many years. So it's very subtle, and I think also maybe a short effect, so this will not last for perhaps more than a couple of minutes, and it's under highly controlled circumstances tested. But there are some studies showing that these effects of subliminal priming can be quite severe and can be also very strong. And our research simply tries to understand what people can do without being aware of it and the implications on application level. Yeah, they are there, but it's a long way to say that these effects are very strong. There's a lot of research going on and needed to test that as well. So, I mean, advertising and that kind of work.
Well, Hank Ott, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hank Ott is lead author of a paper on preparing and motivating behavior outside of awareness. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, money can buy you happiness, particularly if you spend it on someone else. While many studies have examined the effect of income on happiness, Elizabeth Dunn and colleagues hypothesize that spending money on others may provide more happiness than spending it on yourself. The team combined results from a national survey in the United States, an analysis of how people responded to and used bonuses from a Boston area company, and a set of laboratory experiments on psychology undergraduates. The results from all three lines of research indicate that people were happier by spending money on others than on themselves, and that making a donation as small as $5 was sufficient to boost people's happiness on a given day. You can read the paper in this week's Science. 1972 was the year the space shuttle program began. The world had its first commercial handheld scientific calculator, and recombinant DNA was first engineered. There's been a lot of science since then, and along the way, Jean Marks has been covering it for Science Magazine. On news of her retirement, Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall sat down with her to hear about how she became a science writer, changes in science and science journalism, and her thoughts on retirement.
This is Elliot Marshall at Science Magazine. I'm talking today with Jean Marks, editor and writer at Science, who covers biology, biomedicine. She's celebrating her 35th year, and she's retiring this week, so we thought we would just ask a few questions about her experience at Science and as a science writer. I'm going to start with a really obvious question, interesting to me. What prompted you to become a science writer? How did you get started in this business?
Well, it certainly wasn't planned. I was teaching at a small school in St. Louis, small college in St. Louis that was having financial problems, and I and several other faculty members turned out to be part of the solution to those financial problems, as we were terminated for financial exigencies, as they say. So I needed a job and happened to read an ad in Science Magazine, and I applied for the job and ended up as a science writer.
So now, what was your area of concentration at the university, and did it prepare you for being a journalist?
Well, this was a small liberal arts college, so I had to teach a variety of different topics. And actually, that did help because I got introduced to some things that I wouldn't normally have done. I wasn't a specialist. I was more of a generalist, even in teaching.
But you did have a PhD.
I had a PhD in biochemistry.
Now, when you came to Science, I'm curious, did the assignments you got turn out to be sort of what you expected, or was it a shock at the beginning of the kind of assignments you got?
Well, it wasn't so much assignments because we were all pretty much in charge of generating our own stories to write. So this is where the generalist came in because it helped me recognize interesting topics in a variety of fields.
So this is when Alan Hammond was editing the research news at Science.
As it was called then.
Yeah. So you spent the large part of your work just figuring out what was worth writing about.
Right, and that's been the case for the entire 35 years, actually.
Prospecting, yes. So I'm wondering, looking back over this 35-year period, what was sort of the toughest story that you assigned yourself? Do you think of anything that stands out?
Nothing that stands out in particular. I mean, there were tough times, partly because we were expected to write the equivalent of a page a week, which keeps you moving. At one meeting I was at, some young postdoc came up to me and said, oh, she envied me my job because I had so much time to think and read. And I said, if you're writing a page a week, if there's anything you don't have, it's a lot of time to think and read. you have to keep moving and generating ideas and cranking out the copy, basically.
So did that happen often? And what did you tell people about the prospects for working in science writing?
Well, you know, it varied according to the circumstances, because at some points there was more demand for science writers than others. But then, you know, several science publications failed, including the one that the AAAS itself put out over a period of a few years, starting with, it used the year, and I can't remember what the years were at this point, but something like Science 85, you know, 86, whatever. But it became too expensive to maintain, so every time a publication failed, there were, you know, the opportunities became a little bit harder to generate.
So we've been through a sort of a boom and then sort of a bust, or at least a recession. And
right.
Where are we now?
Fortunately, I'm old enough that I don't no longer worry about that.
Just to finish this thought, I mean, what would you say to someone now who came up to you, you know, fresh young PhD, and said, what I really want to do is write about science for a popular audience?
Well, I guess I would tell him or her that, you know, the best way to get that experience is to try to write for publications. I guess we've hired a number of people from, what is it, the Santa Cruz science writing program, and I think it does MIT have a science writing program. But, you know, the best way to get experience writing is writing.
And going back to this theme about stories that are memorable, was there one that you really enjoyed? I mean, that you felt you learned a great deal in a short period of time trying to put this story together that endured?
Well, one of the big things back, I guess, it's in the late 70s through into the 80s, was the discovery of oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, which wasn't one story, but it was a continuing topic that I followed for many years, and in fact, you know, followed up until the end. I mean, the discovery of the first oncogenes, SARC and RAS, it was a real big development back in those days, and it was a lot of fun to write because everybody was excited and so on.
Is there an equivalent field today that or area where you see this kind of excitement?
Well, I guess, you know, genomics and proteomics and various omics.
Everything is spinning out of the genetics. Do you get scientists to open up and reveal their secrets ever, or do you have a technique?
One of the things that's really impressed me over the years is how willing scientists are to spill their research to your intrepid science reporter. I mean, even back when I started in 1972, when nobody heard of me, I mean, I would call up a scientist and say, you know, this is Gene Marks from Science, and next thing you know, they'd be off and running. So there have only been one or two people who have refused to talk to me, and I eventually became friends with one of them. So
I think, we are lucky to be working in a field where people are eager
right.
to be interviewed.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the science magazine cachet, didn't hurt.
Right. I'm curious if you see a sort of a change in the culture of science over this span of 35 years, the way, I guess, scientists see themselves, the way the world sees scientists. Do you think there's a pattern, or are we pretty much at a pretty steady state?
Well, I mean, you know, some things stay the same. I mean, I think, you know, the really good scientists are very interested in their work and, you know, following a problem and trying to solve a scientific issue. I think things are a lot more commercialized these days. That's one thing that wasn't so much so when I started. Now scientists run out and start companies to commercialize their gene discoveries or whatever. So that's a new development. Well, it's not so new anymore, but I mean, that's a big change from the old days.
What about science journalism? Has it changed, do you think?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it's changed to some degree, but nothing stays completely static. But I think good science journalism is pretty much...
It's like good journalism.
It's good journalism.
Yeah.
You know, the multimedia phase probably is coming into its own. We are talking on a podcast, after all. However, I am something of an old fogey, so I haven't been paying a lot of attention to that over the last year or two.
Well, I just am curious about what's it going to be like with no deadlines, no carping editors, no page proofs. Do you have what are you going to do with all this spare time?
That's a really good question too. I'll be looking for some volunteer work. I'm an inveterate duplicate bridge player, so that's two or three times a week that I can do that. To some degree, I mean, it's possible to get off on the pressure, and you know, doing the story on deadline and getting it done even if you are totally exhausted. So, you know, maybe I'm going to miss that high. And I'm not taking any bets on how long it'll be before I'm walking up the walls of my apartment.
Well, we may see you again soon then.
Yeah, all right.
Well, thank you very much.
Okey-doke, thank you.
Senior correspondent Jean Marks talking with Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall on the occasion of her retirement. You can read Jean Marks's final news story for Science on stroma and cancer, which is scheduled to appear in the April 4th issue of Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about the role milk played in mammalian evolution. What causes increased vulnerability to post-traumatic stress disorder? And finally, the amazing gecko tail and how it's inspiring future robots.
Okay, well, let's start then with how milk does evolution good.
Well, Rob, this story is about how mammals evolved and the role that milk played. And mammals first appeared on the scene about 200 million years ago, and they evolved from reptiles. And two of the big things that distinguish mammals from reptiles is, first, that they don't lay eggs, and second, that they nurse their young with milk. But researchers were sort of unclear about when these adaptations happened and how they influenced how mammals evolved.
Did they look at the platypus, which produces both milk and lays eggs?
They did, Rob. It's a good point. They looked at the platypus, which is known as a monotreme, and as you say, it lays eggs and produces milk. And they also looked at dogs and humans and also opossums. And what they did is they looked at the genes in all of these animals, and they compared them to genes that they know in chickens help produce eggs. And all of these genes actually are present in all of the mammals I just mentioned, but not surprisingly, in humans and opossums and dogs, none of the genes work anymore. In platypuses, one of these egg genes still works.
So only one of the three genes is actually needed for laying eggs?
Right, but platypus eggs aren't that similar to reptile eggs. In fact, they have a lot less yolk than reptile eggs, which would make sense if only one of their egg-laying genes is still active.
And the nutrition's then coming from milk, right?
Right, and the nutrition is mainly coming from the milk, not from the egg. And what the researchers found is when they compared all these genes, they found out that these egg-laying genes were shut off about 30 to 70 million years ago. So that gave them their first time frame about exactly when mammals may have stopped laying eggs. So next, the researchers looked at genes involved in milk production. And again, they looked at those four mammals. And what they found is platypuses use the same gene for milk production as humans and possums and dogs do. And why that's important is because platypuses split off from those other mammals about 180 million years ago. And their common ancestor, researchers know, lived about 200 to 300 million years ago. So that means that the ability to produce milk evolved long before ancient mammals stopped laying eggs.
So milk helped drive the evolution of getting rid of egg laying?
Right. And that's because milk presented a few advantages. Because milk provides a source of nutrition that animals would otherwise get from the egg, the parents didn't have to bring food back to their young. They could just nurse their young right in the nest or wherever the young were being raised. And that meant parents could actually devote more time to their offspring. And researchers have found that when more time is devoted to young, young tend to develop larger and develop larger brains, especially. So that was a very important step in mammalian evolution, and especially in human evolution.
Well, from nurturing mammalian young with milk to avoiding post-traumatic stress disorder, what would keep you from being as vulnerable to this complex psychiatric condition?
Well, Rob, just to back up for a second, post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder characterized by extreme anxiety, depression, nightmares. It often follows traumatic events. For instance, a lot of the soldiers coming back from Iraq experience post-traumatic stress disorder. And researchers know that children abused early in life, either sexual or physical abuse, are more likely to be susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder as adults. But they didn't really know why, and they figured that there was some genetic component, but they really weren't sure what it was. So a team of researchers went about trying to figure out, is there a genetic component that predisposes young children who are abused to getting PTSD later in life?
So rather than nature versus nurture, this is sort of nature dancing with nurture,
exactly.
One taking the lead than the other.
Exactly. And one of the genes that they focused on is this gene called FKBP5. And I'll try not to say that again. But basically, this gene is involved in regulating how stress hormones bind to receptors. And researchers thought this might be a critical gene because early childhood abuse is obviously associated with a lot of stress. And any gene involved in stress might be something that would be involved in post-traumatic stress disorder as well. And what they did was they collected data on about 700 people from a poor neighborhood who had been going to a psychiatric clinic for over the course of a couple of years. And these people filled out surveys about what their history of childhood abuse was and what their current history was with things like post-traumatic stress disorder. The researchers also collected DNA samples from these people. And what they found is, as expected, as they knew before, that people who had had traumatic events in childhood were more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. But what was really interesting is that people who had mutations in this gene that I mentioned earlier, FKBP5, were even more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder as adults if they had been abused as children.
So the group that had been abused as children ended up being much more vulnerable to getting this condition.
Right, and especially they were more vulnerable if they had mutations in the gene. And the mutations in the gene weren't enough. If people just had mutations in the gene but weren't abused as children, they weren't any more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder as adults. It was this combination of being abused and having the mutations in the gene, as you said, this dance of nature and nurture, which really made the kids more susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder when they were adults.
Will this be a technique that other psychiatrists will be using in looking at other diseases, this dance between nature and nurture?
Well, it certainly provides further evidence that this relationship is very important, so could definitely be valuable for studying all sorts of other psychiatric disorders. In fact, one researcher said this is potentially the wave of the future.
Wow. From the future of understanding complex psychiatric disorders to the future of robots. How are robotic engineers being inspired by the amazing gecko tail?
Well, Rob, this is a great example of engineers really trying to imitate nature. And what they're trying to imitate here is the gecko tail, which is really amazing. Well, first of all, geckos are really amazing animals anyways. They have these super sticky feet, which allow them to climb upside down, vertical surfaces, all over the place. And they also have these big tails, which actually represent about a tenth of their body weight. So it's a huge investment for them to make these tails. But researchers really didn't think the tail was that special. They thought, well, maybe the geckos were using them to store fat or maybe even as a defense against predators, but they didn't think it had any really special properties. But here's where the robots came in. When researchers tried to make robots that mimicked geckos, so robots that could climb walls, they found that the robots didn't work as well if they didn't have tails. And when they put tails on the robots did a lot better climbing these walls. So that prompted the gecko researchers to go back and say, hey, maybe these tails are more important than we've been giving them credit for. So they put these geckos through an obstacle course, a gecko obstacle course, and they challenged them with a series of tests.
That must have been hard.
It would have been hard for you and me, that's for sure. One of the first tests was having the geckos climb a wall vertically, which is not very hard for a gecko, but the team made it harder by putting a piece of whiteboard on the wall. And whiteboards, as you know, are very slippery. And the geckos had a really hard time climbing that part of the wall. And in fact, when the geckos started to slip a little bit on this whiteboard, they used the tail to balance themselves. They actually used their tail kind of like a kickstand that helped anchor them to the wall. And in the next test, the researchers put the geckos upside down. And not only upside down, they actually put them upside down on a surface that shook back and forth, sort of like a trembling leaf on a tree. And the geckos held on for dear life, but they couldn't hold on forever, and they eventually fell. And much like cats do, the geckos were able to right themselves in midair so that they landed on their feet. And the researchers, using slow motion videography, were able to see that the geckos were actually using their tails to help them spin around in the air so that they would land on their feet. Now, the final test, which was the most challenging part of the obstacle course, is they actually dropped the geckos into a wind tunnel. And most animals would sort of flail around in this wind tunnel and wouldn't look very graceful in the air. But the geckos actually appeared to almost be flying in the wind tunnel. They were gliding, and the researchers noticed that the geckos were using their tails to glide. They almost had this sort of Superman-like pose, and they were using their tails to help them maneuver in the air. So this tail is really amazing. It does a whole lot more for the geckos than researchers ever imagined.
So how will engineers be using this information other than to create robots that climb walls?
Well, now that they know that this tail is so important for balance and climbing and even gliding through the air, researchers say that looking at geckos' tails could influence everything from the design of spacesuits to even improving aircraft design. So not only a really interesting biological story, but a really interesting story about the interplay of biology and engineering.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about new insights into antimatter, how mantis shrimp are revealing a new form of vision, and finally discovering a sea on Saturn's moon Titan that's covered with kilometers thick ice.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of Science. You can check up on the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.com. www.marchtwentyfirst.org. And that wraps up the March 21st, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.